Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how the odds are stacked against people who've been released from prison and why helping them succeed is good for the rest of the community, too. We'll spend this hour with Jason Hardy, who worked as a probation and parole officer in New Orleans before joining the FBI. Hardy's new memoir recalls clients' struggles to find housing, jobs, and health care, without which they became more likely to reoffend or to be victimized themselves. We'll talk about how the job shaped his thinking about drug laws, mass incarceration, and personal responsibility. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
The specific rules vary from place to place, but generally speaking, people on parole or probation are required to check in regularly with an officer to ensure they are following the terms of their release to the community. The deal goes that if you fail to comply, you can be arrested and sent back to prison or jail. But enforcement is actually just a small part of the job for these officers. In a perfect world, they also function as life coaches of a sort, helping their clients adjust to life outside the penal system and pick up their lives as productive members of society. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It turns out to be a tall order for many ex-offenders, in part because of their own mistakes. But as my guest will tell us, they are also facing a system stacked against them even after they have paid their debt to society for their crimes. Jason Hardy is a former probation and parole officer in New Orleans, now a special agent with the FBI. His book is called The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. He joins us from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans to talk about it. Jason, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you describe yourself as being sort of professionally adrift before you became a probation and parole officer, which we might shorthand to PO in the rest of this conversation, by the way. What made you decide to try this line of work?
Well, the most honest answer may be lack of other options. it was late 2011, early 2012. The recession was going strong. There weren't a lot of jobs. I had been selling watches at JCPenney, which was not very lucrative or rewarding. And I was kind of just looking for something else to do. And like a lot of people at that time, I had kind of started hearing about sort of issues with the criminal justice system. And I just out of curiosity, honestly, I started doing some reading. I read, the New Jim Crow, which is kind of the seminal work that sort of looked at kind of drug laws and just the whole system kind of from a different angle. And it just seemed like a really interesting thing to get involved in. And it seemed like something where, if you went in and you were willing to work hard, you could really make a difference.
What exactly does a probation and parole officer do?
Well, the most common shorthand is that you wear two hats, and one is a cop, essentially, where, if someone breaks the law, you have handcuffs, you have a gun, and essentially you take people to jail if need be. And the other one is more like a social worker. And one of the kind of the good and the bad of the job is that you kind of have to toggle back and forth between those two. And sometimes that can be really challenging. And sometimes you might have to wear both hats in, a 30-minute meeting with the same person. And so it can be it can be really rewarding when kind of the social worker side gets through, and then when the cop side gets through, that's usually a bad day.
So what are the most important rules for people on probation and parole? Like what are the things they're not allowed to mess up?
Well, it varies a little bit depending on where you are. And I think one of the things that makes probation and parole a complicated topic to study is that it's, there are hundreds of different agencies that do it. And, from the state to county and parish level to city to federal, and they all do it a little bit differently. But I'd say kind of the things that are true everywhere are, number one, don't get arrested doing anything illegal. In most probation and parole agencies, you're required to drug test at least periodically. And then the other one is that you kind of keep showing up. And sort of under the umbrella of showing up is this kind of laundry list of sort of social markers that show the probation and parole officer that you're trying to rehabilitate yourself. And again, that can mean a lot of different things. But generally, get a job, try to get stable housing, try to maintain, familiar relationships, whatever that means for the individual.
I was surprised to learn that rather than always having your clients come to you, you made home visits as well.
That's the overwhelming majority of the time spent on the job is going out and seeing the person in his or her environment. And it's really, right, in the movies, you kind of always see the parole officer sitting there and, you know, at the desk
big
with his head
desk,
in his hands.
Yeah.
And just like a stamp that says fail to put on every piece of paper. But it's really, there is a desk work component of it for sure. But most of the job is being out in the community and trying to understand this person from seeing him in his environment. And that could be at home, it could be at work. You know, a substantial number of people on probation or parole are homeless. So sometimes it means meeting somebody on the street corner where he's panhandling. So it kind of is dependent on the nature of the caseload that the probation and parole officer has. That'll determine sort of what his field work looks like.
So perhaps one reason that a lot of these folks end up homeless is, as you mentioned, if they were going to live with a family member, in the book you write that if that family member is receiving Section 8 vouchers for housing, which is like a federal housing assistance program, you can't be on parole or probation and live there?
That's right. So if the person's getting, and this too, I think this does vary somewhat state to state, but I think almost everywhere, if the person who has the house voucher, whether it's you know, it's like a housing project or it's Section 8, which is this federal voucher that essentially allows you to you know, get a rent on an apartment anywhere that'll take the voucher, you can't have a probation or a parolee living there. So that takes a lot of housing options off the table. And of course, the probationer and the parolee can't apply for those forms of housing assistance either.
So I want to talk about what you look for when you make one of those visits. One of your first training supervisors, a guy named Charles, you realized that he at least initially noticed minute details in the environment that at first escaped your notice.
Definitely. Charles was very fortunate to have him train me. We just kind of ended up sitting in an office together, and because there wasn't a lot of formal training on the job, you ended up kind of learning from whoever you happened to be in the room with. Mm-hmm. And that could vary wildly. But Charles really was and still is an expert at kind of picking up on these little cues that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know to look for without having done it for a while, or at least I didn't. And it could be as simple as, you know, you walk in a house and you kind of figure out who's running the show there. And so, you know, sometimes it's the probationer or the parolee. Sometimes, you know, I remember a couple of times he'd tell me, hey, you know, the grandmother is really the boss here. You know, if we can get her on our side, then we can influence the person that we're trying to influence. He would pick up on things like the, you know, maybe the dynamic in a relationship, or he might notice, you know, maybe the way the children were treated. And there were times when we might have to get involved in that issue, which was always kind of a messy situation. But, you know, you're kind of, and this again gets back to the idea of wearing two hats, you're looking for kind of emergencies first. So if you go in there and you see something that's a threat, you know, if you see a gun lying around, or you see somebody who's hurt or in danger, then you kind of have to be the police and deal with it. But that's less than 1% of the time. The rest of the time, you're really trying to learn this person whose life you're trying to help.
I never got the sense reading the book that you were afraid of your clients. It sounds more like you were just able to see that a lot of them were just a mess, which is not to say that they hadn't done things that were dangerous or wouldn't go on to do things that were bad.
I didn't feel afraid very often, and that's not because I'm brave or anything. It's really a credit to the folks we supervised. By and large, I found that they were very willing to kind of let us take our crack at helping them out, and even though many of them had been in the system for a long time and had not really gotten any help from it. Most people were really, you know, if you showed up at the house and you said, hey, I don't have a lot of resources, but I'd like to help you if I can, that plays with most people, you know, and that I think it transcends race, gender, you know, whatever you bring to the table. I think if you show up and you're actually making an effort to help, people will meet you in the middle. Now, that's not to say that there weren't dangerous situations that arose now and then, but by and large, I found that people were very kind of willing to hear what I had to say.
One of the most important early lessons you learned was that first contact, which I guess is that moment when you lay your hands on a client to handcuff them and take them off to jail. That was really important. Why is that?
Well, that's kind of just an old law enforcement go-by that, you know, if you have to arrest somebody, you have to kind of act like you've been there before. And of course, there's a first time for mm-hmm. everybody. But you know, if it actually is maybe the inverse of the thing I just said about kind of showing up at the house and saying you're there to help. If you're there to be the police, you know, you need to be assertive, and it's safer for everybody if you kind of, you know, get the handcuffs on, tell the person, you know, everything's going to be okay, but he's kind of got to take this ride that he doesn't want to take. And again, that's always a, in this job, that's always a low moment, because that means whatever it was that you were trying to do, whatever change you were trying to make, it didn't get made. And so now you have to deal with it in a way that, you know, frankly, is generally doesn't lead to a lot of reform, and is also, you know, the most expensive solution too. And I mean, that's one of the things that we came back to again and again in the job, is that it's not just unpleasant to arrest somebody. It's not just that he's given up his freedom, but, you know, when you put somebody in jail, it's a huge expense, and you know, there's always an opportunity cost. Every dollar you're spending on jail is a dollar you're not spending on other ways to rehabilitate people.
Yeah, I gained a new perspective on this, because I think a lot of people feel like, you know, spending money on prisons and jails is just something we have to do as a society. You discover that we actually spend more putting people behind bars than on the services that some of your clients needed. But a lot of taxpayers are like, no, that's rewarding them for having committed a crime.
Right. I think that's kind of where this is just a challenging topic, is that I feel like if my experiences were any indication, and I've talked to POs all over the country about this, more often than not, getting someone social services will rehabilitate him, meaning he'll stop going back to jail, a lot more quickly and a lot more cost effectively than just continuing to put handcuffs on him, lock him up, let him out a year later. But there is that just sort of ideological thing to it, where it seems like, you know, you're essentially spending public money on someone who has violated the law, you know, and you can kind of play devil's advocate and say, well, if someone is not violating the law and doesn't get help with housing, why is someone who is breaking the law getting help with housing? And frankly, I'm not a politician. I don't have the answer to that. But what I can say is that, you know, to take housing just for one example, if someone is homeless and on parole, the chances of recidivism are almost 100.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the person can get housing, then you have a better chance of the person getting a job. So if the person gets a job, then there might be a chance that he can get some kind of health insurance, even if it's Medicaid. And so as you kind of work your way up that social services ladder, the recidivism rate continues to go down. And so, and like I said, I'm a taxpayer like everybody else. I have mixed feelings about, you know, how money should be spent, like everybody does. But I can say that within this world that I experienced, most of the money that you spend on these folks, you know, you get back in increased public safety and less recidivism.
What schedule did you have for seeing your clients?
That varied a lot. It really, one of the things that I think is kind of a hot debate right now, and not just probation and parole, but kind of everything having to do with the justice system and corrections, is these risk assessments. And there are a million different versions of them. And again, it varies by jurisdiction. But when you have really high caseloads like we did in New Orleans, I normally had about 220 people on my caseload. Obviously, you know, you can't see everybody every week. And so you kind of triage by putting all these folks through one of these risk assessments, and that determines how often you see them. And I actually found that our assessment got decent results, and that, you know, if you kind of looked at it subjectively, it seemed like, hey, the people we were spending most of our time on were kind of the neediest and the most troubled. But, you know, it's again, you're using an algorithm to try to predict human behavior, so it's not easy. Most of these risk assessments, though, they look at the things you would think: history of addiction, history of mental health problem, criminal record, and then socioeconomic status. And you kind of shake that up in the magic eight ball, and it sort of gives you some idea of how much time you should spend per person.
So medium risk versus maximum risk is not necessarily about the nature of the crime that got them into trouble in the first place.
No, although that's kind of another thing that's considered. So again, depending on jurisdiction, different crimes may be supervised different ways. You know, if someone is strictly on for like a low grade drug offense versus someone who's on for, you know, is on parole for, let's say, like rape or some kind of very serious crime, there are certain crimes where, you know, you couldn't get below medium risk. If mm-hmm. it's a really serious crime, they're going to want to be seen more. There are other crimes where, you know, even if you have a lot of those other markers of risk, if the nature of the crime was fairly benign, you know, you're probably not going to end up on the one visit a week list.
You had another colleague named Beth who helped to train you, and you say she cared about her clients as much as Charles did, but she had a really different point of view on things.
She did, yeah. And this was one of the things that I found really interesting about this workplace, was that I don't know if I've ever worked anywhere where more people not only really cared about the job, but would spend time kind of debating each other about, you know, what was the best way to do it. And one of the funny things was that there wasn't a There wasn't a ton of empirical evidence that one way worked better than another, but some people were tougher, some people were more lenient, and, you know, you kind of watched and saw what happened.
My guest is Jason Hardy. His book is The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jason Hardy. He's a former probation and parole officer, now a special agent with the FBI, and author of a book called The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. I asked you about Beth before the break, Jason, and didn't give you very much time to tell us about her. So what was her approach to this work that she did?
Her approach was that you really couldn't make any progress without accountability. And obviously, accountability can be kind of a slippery term, but she really felt like even in cases where maybe, you know, and I say in some cases, in the overwhelming majority of cases, we didn't have a lot of resources to offer folks. You know, a lot of what we were trying to do was sit down with them, kind of let them vent, give them a pep talk, and then send them on our way. And you know, one of the cases I really like to make when I talk about this stuff is that, you know, the more money you invest in resources, kind of the more you can get out of those conversations. You know, if you can end a conversation and say, all right, you want to get clean, let me help you, rather than, okay, we talked about it, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But Beth kind of had this mindset of, look, I'm going to kind of tell you what the rules are, and I'm going to tell you what the consequences are if you can't follow the rules. And in her way of looking at the issue, especially with something like addiction, she felt like, you know, people kind of needed tough love, and that, you know, if all you ever did was tell people it wasn't their fault, or you kind of said, well, let's give you, you know, strike 7 and strike 8, that ultimately that was going to be worse off for that person you were trying to supervise. And one of the things that I found so interesting about this work is that most people were a little bit ideological about it that way. They kind of lean more one way or the other. And yet I think anyone in an honest moment would tell you that no one approach worked all the time. And I think that over time, at least for me, I found that the pendulum swung a little bit. There would sort of be people where I felt like I had to kind of take a firmer hand. And there were others where I really felt like this person just kind of needs an extra break, you know, and being tough with them is kind of not the way to get the best outcome.
Because most of what I know about this whole process comes from TV and movies, which I am aware are not that accurate. I have to say, I was, Jason, genuinely moved by your accounts of judges, especially judges behind closed door, not in open court, talking to you less like somebody who wanted to throw the book at, you know, every offender who messed up again, but talking to you almost like you were a high school teacher and they were a high school principal and you were trying to figure out what to do about this kid who had potential but had really messed up.
And truly, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to kind of give perspective not only of the people who were caught up in this system, but the efforts that are being put in by the people who are working in the system. And I really was fortunate to work with a lot of judges who really, really were trying hard to find better outcomes for people. And interestingly, several of the judges who I worked with had been prosecutors kind of in the 90s, you know, the time that we think of now as the kind of throw the book at them era, and had sort of taken on a very different perspective toward criminal justice, you know, 15, 20 years later. But it kind of comes down to the same theme that it's very hard to find kind of one solution that works for everybody. And even if you maybe are more of the mindset that we should be fighting mass incarceration, or someone who's more of the mindset of, oh, we've taken this too far, people need to be in jail, there's no one ideology that holds up all the time. And I think the people who are best at this work are the ones who can really be fluid about it. And I was fortunate to have judges who really would sit there and say, okay, tell me everything you know about this person. What do you think is the best way either to get him clean or to get him to stop committing acts of violence, or, you know, whatever the problem was, everybody was willing to try to think outside the box and come up with some new answers.
We talked a few minutes ago about accountability for ex-offenders. Were you held accountable if someone you supervised did a really bad thing on your watch?
No, truthfully, I, you know, you hold yourself accountable, but I think that the way that the system is set up, frankly, I mean, it wouldn't be realistic for our bosses to say, hey, you know, you're on the hook for every bad thing that someone on your caseload does. You know, even in the cases where we were spending the most time with someone, you know, you're talking about maybe an hour a month for, you know, a really, really high risk case. So, no, I don't think you can hold probation and parole officers accountable every time something goes wrong. But I did feel that my bosses were good about kind of sitting down with us, honestly, sometimes as much as once a week, and just kind of giving you, I mean, these are almost like therapy sessions where you said, okay, you know, what's working, what's not working, what can you do better, what can we do better? And again, one of the running themes was that a lot of times we were asking for support that we just didn't have funding for. You know, I mean, we had a lot of people overdose on our watch, you know, and a lot of times we would tell our bosses, hey, you know, if we had a reliable detox and we didn't have to just put people in jail every time they got high, they might be more likely to come in and tell us that they'd relapsed. And then we could, you know, we could help them in a way that was a little bit less abrasive and maybe, you know, they'd be more candid with us about what their issues were. So, no, I can't say that I was held personally accountable, but I think anybody who stays in the job will tell you that you really, you know, you feel those losses on a personal level. It's hard to leave them at the office.
It took that toll on you, and you were advised by colleagues, like, be careful how much you bring home to your girlfriend, to people you care about, because it will start to mess up your relationships.
Yes, it will. And I have my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, has been more patient with me than I deserve. But this is a problem. I mean, I think this is true, honestly, in a lot of law enforcement jobs. You know, police suicides have been way up the last couple of years. But I think with this job, the stress takes a slightly different form, because you really get to know these people that you're dealing with. You know, it's not like you just work a case, you slap the handcuffs on somebody, and you move on to the next one. I mean, sometimes the people who you're either putting in jail or who are getting themselves back in trouble, you might have spent a couple of years trying to work with this person. And so there is some kind of a personal relationship there, and you just can't help take it personally when things don't work out the way that you wanted them to.
I think a lot of these stories that you tell will stay with me. Sheila, I found particularly compelling. I think she was like 18 when she became your client, and
yes,
she had developed this unfortunate attraction to drug dealers. What was that about, and what did it have to do with the trouble she had with the law?
Well, I think what it was about was she lived in a really poor neighborhood where you know, being a drug dealer was kind of the quickest way to upward mobility, for lack of a better word for it, you know. And I mean, this was something that we saw a lot, whether you were a girlfriend looking to date someone or you were a young man trying to kind of make his way in the world, when there didn't appear to be a lot of paths to, you know, being a doctor, a lawyer, kind of these conventional well-paying jobs, people kind of look around and say, okay, who has the resources, you know? And very often in the neighborhoods that we were in, it was the people who were selling drugs. And so one of the things that I found where I had to really recalibrate my expectations was looking at the ways that you know, criminal behavior could seem rational to people, you know, and say, like, I could tell Sheila, hey, I don't want you to date a drug dealer. This guy is, you know, he carries a gun. He's dangerous, and he's in danger kind of in equal measure. But I could understand why for her that seemed like a rational choice. You know, this guy's making money. People give him a wide berth. He gets kind of respect on the street. And so, like I said, it wasn't what I wanted for her, but I could see the rationality behind that choice.
How did you get her into therapy?
Well, kind of through repeated failure until I kind of got some luck. We tried a number of things. I think the first thing we tried was to get her back in school, but that didn't take. She'd kind of just decided that she was done with school. What we ultimately were able to do was to get her some therapy through the courthouse. I was lucky when I was there. The courthouse was expanding this program that they just kind of colloquial called mental health court. And essentially what it was if you had somebody on probation who seemed to be exhibiting symptoms of some kind of a mental health problem, they could get kind of programming through the courthouse. And this was a model that I really kind of think is the best way to do probation, especially for people who have kind of more serious needs, is that you get kind of more accountability in that these programs, the person's in front of a judge, you know, once a week or at least a couple times a month, so that if something's going wrong, the judge can intercede. But in exchange for that increased accountability, they get a lot more resources. She could meet with a psychiatrist. She could meet with a therapist. She had a social worker. And again, kind of the recurring theme with all this is that when people get services, generally you can do a lot more with them. And so for her, we were able to get her those services through the courthouse. And we found out that she, you know, she was suffering from pretty severe depression. And so she kind of gave up smoking weed 4 or 5 times a day for getting actual meds. And that seemed to have a much better result.
A lot of your clients, including folks with diagnosable mental illnesses and drug problems, they were pretty self-aware about their problems. It was not that they didn't understand that they could use some help. They just often couldn't get to it.
That's right. That was something that we saw over and over again. It was that now, certainly not everybody. Some people were in denial. Some people there were cases that, you know, we could get the person to resources and the person wasn't ready. But I found with mental health, people were pretty aware that they had an issue, you know, and especially folks who were living on the street, you know, they could look around them and say, hey, my life is not going how I want. You know, we had a couple of guys, especially people who had, you know, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, where they could see that, you know, they would be stable for a week and then they'd have an episode and they would act out. And that would, you know, that could lead to a new charge or, you know, to getting hurt, all kinds of bad outcomes. But the problem was there really wasn't a mechanism in place for us to get them care. I'm happy to say that is better now than when I left. There's a kind of a public provider here in the city where you can essentially, you know, you can walk in off the street and meet with a doctor and get a diagnosis. Now, it's not quite that simple, but, you know, when I was there really was no way to do that. And in fact, one of the stories I tell in the book is of a guy where the only way that we could get him diagnosed with a mental health disorder so that we could get him meds was actually to put him back in prison for 90 days because the Department of Corrections was the only place that had a doctor he could see for free.
Is in Louisiana, is the criminal justice system, the penal system, equipped to provide mental health care when people are incarcerated?
You know, I'd be reluctant to say just because I don't know enough about how things work within the prisons to be sure. Mm-hmm. I can say that there seems to be a lot of momentum toward addressing mental health in jail and once people get out. Like I said, I mean, as simple as it seems, going from a system where if someone was on parole and he came in our office and said, I have mental health problems, I need help, and we said, you know, I don't know what to tell you, versus now you can actually send someone somewhere where he can meet with a psychiatrist and get meds. I mean, that's a sea change. You know, that makes a massive difference. As far as within the prisons, one thing I did see before I left was they started a new program where if you were doing time and you had about 6 months left and you had a record of mental health issues, they would actually kind of get you on meds while you were in there and then make sure that you know, if you were eligible for Medicaid, that you had those papers filled out before you left. That way, even if you were going to a shelter, at least when you got out, you were kind of cycling through your meds and you had access to getting that prescription filled when you got out. And that too, that didn't exist 6 or 7 years ago. And now, as far as I know, it's pretty much standard practice.
One of your duties, of course, was to enforce the law, but you also had to sort of learn that some rules were more important to enforce than others. Can
sure.
you talk a little bit about how you put marijuana use in context among your clients?
Well, that was another thing that kind of changed just in the time I was there. When I was first there, generally we were told, hey, if you walk in and people are smoking weed, you know, you've got to take them to jail. Not generally for a long time, but, you know, kind of to send the message that wasn't going to be tolerated. And by the time I left, that wasn't really the policy anymore. I mean, it was kind of more like, well, you know, treat every case kind of in a totality of the circumstances kind of way. You know, if this person is making a lot of headway and kind of the one issue you see is that, you know, there's a little bit of marijuana at the house, you know, maybe we don't want to derail the other progress by putting this person in jail. And so that was kind of the calculus of a lot of things was that, I mean, look, if you walk in and there's a gun lying on the counter, you don't have any discretion that, mm-hmm. you know, you have to confiscate the gun and that person has to go to jail. But with regard to drugs, we got more flexibility as we went. And I think I saw the kind of just the general mindset change to where, you know, anything that we could deal with outside of jail, it was going to be less costly, and in many cases, it was going to have a better outcome.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. This book also caused me to think about the ways that class plays into our judgment of particular parents and their choices. You write about these two brothers and their mother. You know, they've both been involved with the law, with the legal system. Their mother basically allows them to stay home and do nothing all day while she works. But in her mind, there's a pretty rational calculation there.
Yes. So her calculation was that, you know, both of her sons, one was in his late 20s, one was 30. They had both lived in Central City, which is arguably the most violent neighborhood in New Orleans. And her, I think her calculation was that they had kind of, for lack of a better word, survived kind of the most dangerous years of their lives in the most dangerous neighborhood in one of the most dangerous cities in the country. And she felt like kind of the best thing she could do for them is just kind of keep them inside, you know, where they were safe. And, you know, their reasons for not working were complicated. One of them had a disability and the other one had a really long record. So, you know, I it wasn't quite as simple as they just didn't want to work, but, she wasn't looking to kind of force the issue. She felt like, look, you know, my sons are safe. They're alive. They're home. You know, and she was willing to make two jobs, you know, working, you know, anywhere from 50 to 80 hours a week just to kind of keep the lights on and make sure they were provided for.
So the disabled brother had pretty severe epilepsy. Why was it so hard for him to get disability?
Well, the disability system is complicated, and I think the way I kind of came to understand it is like some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. You know, it's public money that's being handed out to people who have a need for it. And so the system is set up, obviously, to kind of weed out fraud and to make sure it's going to the worthiest people, because there's a limited amount of it. But one of the unintended consequences that we saw a lot was that people who were truly disabled didn't really have kind of the wherewithal to sort of navigate the program to actually get qualified for disability. It involves, you know, kind of going to see a doctor and then getting in front of a judge and filling out a lot of forms. Whereas on the other side of that coin, we had a lot of people who were not disabled, namely our kind of more successful drug dealers, who kind of figured out how to get access to every public benefit there was. Hmm. So it seemed like kind of people who didn't need it were able to get it, and people who needed it were not able to get it. So that's obviously not how the system's supposed to work. But like a lot of other things that we were encountering, you know, I couldn't really sit there and shake my fist at the people who are working this system, because they were kind of in the same boat we were. They had limited resources. They were doing the best they could. But, you know, this is not straightforward stuff.
So you are from New Orleans, like all the people that you were working with here. I gather you grew up in like a middle class situation, a different sort of neighborhood than most of your clients lived in.
Yes.
Did you realize that you had just not understood a lot about your own city before you had this job?
No, I mean, obviously, I was in for a lot of awakenings when I took this job. I didn't go into it thinking that, you know, I was just going to show up and everybody was going to listen to what I had to say and that I was going to have the answers for all this stuff. But I did, you know, one of the biggest surprises for me was I kind of just thought the fact that I cared would really separate me out from other people. Hmm. And the fact that, you know, and again, this was in part because of the reading I was doing, kind of just a lot of the negative coverage of law enforcement at the time. I kind of thought, well, maybe I'm not qualified for this job, but most of the people who are doing it don't even care. So by virtue of the fact that I care, maybe I can get better outcomes. And so one of the first big shocks was that actually pretty much everybody cared a lot. And, you know, the bad outcomes weren't for lack of caring. It was because lack of resources was kind of the prevailing thing over and over again.
My guest is Jason Hardy, a former probation and parole officer, now a special agent with the FBI. We're talking about his book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former probation and parole officer Jason Hardy, who is now a special agent with the FBI and author of a new book called The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. We have an email here, Jason, from Kevin, who wants to know what you think about full restoration of citizen rights for nonviolent or no-victim felons, things like DWIs and drug charges.
You said citizen rights?
Citizen rights. I'm assuming Kevin means things like
voting rights.
Rights
and things like that. I mean, I'm certainly in favor of that. I think one of the things that makes a lot of sense, if we really want people to not commit the crimes that, you know, got them in jail over and over again, is to try to help life get back to normal. Or if life has never been normal for the person, to try to help them get there. And I think things like that, you know, and in some ways it can be a carrot for someone. Like, hey, you know, you do what we ask you to do, you complete this program, and then you kind of get to hit the reset button. I think that makes all the sense in the world.
Are the higher level folks in drug dealing organizations, are they like more evil than the lower level folks? Have they just been more successful at this thing?
I mean, I hate to use the word evil. I mean, I think
more
like
culpable?
I said, my perspective on this really, like I said, it had to do with kind of looking at a lot of the neighborhoods that these folks are in. And I think for a lot of people, it starts out, you know, being a drug dealer starts out as a way to kind of survive until you can get on to something else. And then, you know, if the money is good and if you kind of move up in the world, then you're faced with a situation that a lot of folks that I was supervising were faced with, which is, okay, I'm living pretty well doing what I'm doing. If I bail out of this, it's going to be, you know, minimum wage and starting at the bottom. And I think that's something that, again, even if you're able to confront kind of the ethical issues with drug dealing, the fear of violence and everything else that comes with it, it's still hard to kind of walk away from a good paycheck and go start at the bottom somewhere. But as far as kind of what makes someone rise up, you know, one of the things I found really interesting that one guy told me and other people told me different versions of this is that part of the appeal of being a drug dealer is this kind of idea that it's like a meritocracy, meaning that, you know, it doesn't matter what your race is or you know, kind of where you came from. It's sort of all about hustle, you know, and look, sometimes it's about ruthlessness, too. But You know, if you come from an area where there doesn't seem to be a lot of opportunity, there's something kind of appealing about this idea that, like, there's this thing that I can do, and if I just work harder and push more than the next guy, I can get to the top.
One idea that you have endorsed is combining or compressing 5 years of visits and services into two. Can you explain what that would allow for?
Well, I think just, you know, there's sort of like perfect world solutions, and there's sort of solutions that I think we can get done. And I mean, this is in the latter category, but, you know, I think if you're trying to improve the system without spending a lot more money or dramatically changing it, I think one of the quickest ways to do that is, instead of spending 5 years, you know, seeing somebody two or three times a year, if you spend 2 years seeing him monthly, and then having the resources that, again, that were originally spread out over five, to actually provide him with, you know, whatever he needs. I mean, a GED or a detox, or, I mean, you kind of have to tailor that to the individual. But I just think 2 years of quality supervision that are really focused on rehabilitation are going to get you a better outcome than 5 years of just kind of, you know, glancing in on this person every now and then. And kind of with regard to the sort of law enforcement side of this, it's also generally, in my experience, kind of the first 2 years are when you're really going to see if the person is going to go back to old habits too. So, you know, if you have kind of public safety concerns, I found that generally that window was enough to see if the person was going to go back to what he was doing before.
Is it possible to name a percentage of people who had what you would consider happy outcomes in the end?
Wow. I've never tried to put a number on it. I would say that it's low. I know that's not a satisfying answer. Honestly, one of the ways I came to look at it were sort of short-term happy endings. I guess ending isn't the word there, but, you know, you kind of learn to say, like, okay, if I can help this person to stay clean for a month, I've got to look at that as a little win. You know, if I can help this person get off the street for, you know, a couple of days, you know, find his way into a shelter, that's a win. As far as long-term, I really, frankly, don't think that we very often had the resources to really make long-term changes. It was more short-term. Now, I will say one of the most pronounced things you would see is if you got someone from homelessness to a stable residence, that was probably the most lasting change you could see, because, as I mentioned earlier, it often led to other things. You know, if you can get housing, then you might be able to get a job and hold down a job. And then if you have a job, then you might be able to get health insurance. And so those things kind of have a compound effect. But you know, day in, day out, no, I would say that lasting change was really beyond our abilities.
Let's speak now with Kim in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I didn't catch the beginning, but if he could clarify how long he worked at that job, because the issue seems to be about the pay and why did he leave that job for the FBI. I'm a retired special ed teacher, and so I survived or lasted 15 years. I can understand that predicament. It's obviously a lack of funding to feel successful in any field, and that's what I keep hearing over and over.
Thanks for calling. Why did you leave, Jason?
Sure. So I was there a little over 4 years. Certainly the low pay is responsible for a lot of the turnover. I would say, though, that I think lack of resources to help the people in your caseload probably drives people away even more than the pay, though, honestly. I mean, I think, again, in a perfect world, this would be a well-paying job that was seen as, you know, the key to safer streets in America. I mean, I really think that if it's properly funded, it can be that. But I, to be honest with you, I think even if the pay were a lot more than what it was, I still would have left. And that's really more a reflection on me than on the job. I just hit burnout, to be honest. And, you know, I certainly tip my hat to folks who can do that kind of public service for longer. But for me, kind of by the end, I felt like I was kind of losing my patience. I wasn't as, I don't know what the right word is. I don't know. I wasn't as forgiving or I just had a harder time kind of giving people the benefit of the doubt. I just felt kind of jaded by the end of it. And I felt like it was kind of time to move on to something else.
Are there ways in which you think your time as a probation and parole officer informs the way you work as a special agent with the FBI?
Sure. I mean, I think, like, if you work in a couple of different kind of facets of the criminal justice system, I mean, like anything else, the more you know about it, the better. I think I just tend to think of justice in a more kind of holistic way than I would have otherwise. You know, I mean, now I'm more on the side of, you know, kind of one of the running jokes we talk about in the book is this idea that it's easier to solve a crime than a person. That was sort of a joke we had with cops, where, you know, if you're investigating a crime, you know, you figure out who did it. You bring them to the judge, and then you kind of move on to the next thing. With probation and parole, you're with the person again for years sometimes. So I think I've moved on to a job that maybe I'm a little bit better suited to, but I still think about kind of the end result. You know, if I arrest somebody, my hope is that that's not the end of the story, that person gets rehabilitated and then they don't do it again. You know, and I think probation and parole is really helpful in thinking about what is the system really supposed to be about. It's you know, you want to stop people who are threats to themselves or to other people, and then you want them at the end of this experience to have the tools to not do it again.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Damien calling from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Damien.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
I was just wondering, did the office ever find, with working with people out of prison, getting out of prison, trying to make a change in life, did he ever meet people who tried to find some sort of spirituality to, you know, in their lives to help them, you know, make really good decisions and stuff? Or did he have anybody like that?
Thanks for calling.
Oh, absolutely. Spirituality was huge for people, and obviously it can take different shapes, but and truly a lot of kind of rehabilitation programs that we might think of as secular, like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, you know, a lot of times they'll encourage people to kind of have a spiritual side to their recovery. And one of the things that I kind of learned to do over time is, you know, if something was working for someone in his recovery, and again, be that recovery from a life of violence or a life of addiction or whatever it was, you know, as long as it wasn't harmful to someone else, we tried to encourage it. And so, you know, there were people who would come in and tell me that they joined a religion I'd never heard of. But, you know, if it was keeping their head clean and if it was giving them some sense of purpose, and again, it wasn't harmful to others, we always said, hey, you know, whatever works for you, as long as it's getting the right outcome, you know, we're behind you on that.
How did your years as a probation and parole officer shape the way you feel about medication-assisted addiction treatment?
Well, I mean, I should say I'm obviously not an expert on addiction. I mean, I kind of have only my own experiences to go on. But I guess I kind of take what a lot of people just call the harm reduction approach with it, which is that I certainly don't have the answer for how we solve the addiction problem in America. But I think that, you know, any kind of medically assisted solution that, you know, decreases overdose rates is something that we have to at least take seriously, you know. And I mean, I know that even though overdose rates are still high, I mean, I think we had, 70,000 last year. I mean, things like Narcan have saved thousands of lives. So I think those solutions are often short term. I mean, unfortunately, there are these horror stories of someone who gets revived with Narcan and then goes out and ODs 3 hours later. But I think one good thing about the moment we're in now is that there's really like a wide bipartisan consensus that, you know, we have to do something about the drug problem in this country. And I think that there's just a lot more kind of open-mindedness about different solutions, where, you know, 10 years ago, people basically said, well, lock them up, let them out 2 years later, and hopefully they're clean.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Something that's easy to forget if we are fortunate enough to be pretty far outside this whole system is that these folks, you know, they have families. They're usually tied into people who care about them in some way. And like the overdose thing, to think about, even if your adult child is like really in the throes of a terrible addiction, if they overdose, there are people who are horribly affected by this.
Absolutely. And but part of the job, if you're a probation and parole officer, is that sooner or later, someone in your caseload is going to overdose. And nowadays, it probably happens every month or two for most probation and parole officers. And then, you have to go talk to the family, and, you know, you have to kind of sit there and determine what, if anything, you know, you could have done differently. And certainly it doesn't fall just on the authority figure. But I think when people die of overdoses, everyone who's been in contact with this person kind of can't help but do some sort of soul searching and say, you know, what could we have done? And this is kind of going back to what we were discussing earlier about, you know, people taking different approaches to this kind of work, you know, whether to be kind of the tough guy or kind of the compassionate person. This is where it really gets hard, because I think most of us have had, you know, some time in our life where we needed kind of a firm hand, you know, and I think we've had times in our lives where we needed somebody to go easy on us. And I think when people have family members who are addicts, this is something that they struggle with all the time. You know, is this a day when he needs compassion, or is this a day when he needs kind of that tough love? And I don't know that anybody really has a universal answer for that.
One of the things you write, and we'll stress that you did not have an addiction problem, but some of the people you were dealing with, like, were the same age as you'd been in college and kind of wanted the same things, like to get high and to talk to girls, and but the context was incredibly different.
Yeah, that was kind of one of my awakening moments was, you know, hanging around guys who were 18 or 19 and, you know, lived, I don't know, 10 miles from where I grew up. But our lives were just on different trajectories that had more to do with where we were from than, you know, our morality or intelligence or anything like that. And, you know, I just kind of would think to myself, hey, when I was 18, I was shipping off to college and, you know, I wanted to have a good time. I wanted to meet girls. And these guys kind of want the same things, but just the kind of pathway to those outcomes was just very different for them. And again, this is not to say that I went around saying, you know, people don't have any responsibility for their actions, but it was, for me at least, helpful to think about how kind of where you grow up is just going to kind of determine sort of what those outcomes look like and what you think is sort of the best way to get to them.
How did you learn to manage this emotionally taxing job and also keep good relationships with your girlfriend, now your wife?
Well, I didn't always manage very well. I found that, I don't know, I guess it was a little bit of a bell curve. I guess I found by my second and third year, I was getting better at kind of, you know, leaving the office whenever I left it and trying to go home and just frankly kind of turn off that part of my mind and just say, hey, if I want to have a home life with someone and if I want to kind of be able to decompress, I just have to put the job out of my mind. And I think, frankly, one of the things that kind of drove me out toward the end was that I sort of backslid on that. You know, I just found that it got a lot harder at the end of the day to, I don't know, just to say, hey, I did my best and, you know, obviously I didn't get great outcomes, but I'm going to try again tomorrow. And I just found that was something that I kind of lost the capacity to do as time went on.
Is that easier to do at the FBI?
I know that seems counterintuitive, but I find that, again, going back to that old joke about solving a crime versus solving a person, I think that in any kind of conventional law enforcement job, you have these kind of end notes that come a lot more frequently where, you know, you have a case. And again, whether you're working burglary or white collar crime or whatever, you know, you sort of have a case and you wrap it up and then you move on to the next thing. And I think the fact that you have that closure kind of allows you to decompress more than you can if you're carrying the same person's life around for a couple of years and seeing the same mistakes over and over again.
Jason Hardy is a former probation and parole officer in New Orleans, now a special agent with the FBI. His book is called The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Jason, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.